Okay.
Good evening. I want to thank all of you for coming. We're here to do something that is unusual for our shul, which is to have an askara for a person who is not a member of our community. But I think in many ways, Rav Aaron was the role model that our community stands for. Rav Aaron represented the ideals that our modern Orthodox Torah committed, more than just Torah committed, but people who aspire to grow in Torah and people who value secular culture as an ideal, we have not that many role models, but Rav Aaron, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was one of those role models. The Gemara tells us in Moed Katan that when a Chacham Shemes Beis Midrashel is batel, Rashi understands that after a Talmud Chacham dies, so the Beis Midrash of that Talmud Chacham focuses on who that Talmud Chacham was. And that Beis Midrash of that Talmud Chacham gives hespedim for the Talmud Chacham, because the people in his Beis Medrash, in the Talmud Chacham's Beis Medrash, understood best what that Talmud Chacham stood for. Our Beis Medrash here, we have Rav Aaron Sfarim right here on the shelf, and all modern Orthodox Batei Medrash, I think, should be batel, because Rav Aaron is not with us. It's my pleasure to call on first some community members who were Talmidim of Rav Aaron to share a few words. So first I'd like to call on Morty Weasel. Bevakasha.
Thank you, Rav Schwartz. So I first want to express my appreciation and my gratitude for the opportunity to say a couple of words about Mori V'Rabbi Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. For those people who have not an opportunity yet to read any of the eulogies and spadim and the ubiquitous writings that have come out over the past week about who he was and what he stood for, I certainly encourage you to do so. Those of you who have, I'm going to touch on some of the things that certainly came across. Certainly what I heard from a number of those things that I've read and listened to over the past week. And I repeat them not because I couldn't think of anything else to say, but because for one of the few people I've ever experienced in life where all the eulogies about him were not exaggerated, but simply true. And for that reason, and that reason alone, I think it's important to go over some of those things. But on the other hand, I want to add the caveat that what I'm saying is not, I do not mean to encompass or express the totality of the man or what he stood for, but simply some of my reflections as a student of his. And I was a student of Rav Lichtenstein in the twilight of his career. He had a very long and what seemed to be a very various career of teaching Torah. He, over the course of time in Israel, gave the Shir Yomi in Gush, gave Shir Kolei in Gush, gave Shir the Kol HaGavoah in Gush, gave Shir in Grus, and that's not to mention the assorted other public speakings that he had. By the time I was in his Shir, it was already the end of the time. I was one of the last Machzorim to have the opportunity to hear Shir Yomi from Rav Lichtenstein soon after he stopped giving Shir in Grus, etc. And in that way, as I was at the twilight of his career, the Rav Lichtenstein that I knew was, in a certain sense, a fully mature, the full Gedol HaTorah that he would be, inasmuch as any man in certain Rav Lichtenstein stopped growing. I don't know how much you can possibly say that. But he was the figure that we now think of him as. And as a teenager going into yeshiva, this was a very awe-inspiring, very intimidating sort of experience. I actually have a very clear memory of speaking to one of my friends while we were in yeshiva that before we got to yeshiva, there are a number of stories in Sefer Chazal that talk about certain people who, when they would learn Torah, certain things around them would be engulfed in flame, be it birds or sacks of hay and things like that. And I never really understood what those meant until I met Rav Lichtenstein, because his stare was so intense that you were actually on some level afraid that you might burst into flame. And in that way, as I mentioned Monday Night Learning last week, and as this was a Gemara that was I heard quoted by a number of different people, that Rav Lichtenstein was the Doma Lumish, you learn from someone who's Doma Lamalach, you should learn from he was angelic, he was an angel. I think this is certainly true of Rav Lichtenstein. However, I want to share a couple of anecdotes about reflections of what I was thinking about. Why was it truly, really, you know, that inspiring to learn from Rav Lichtenstein? So the first, I can't speak to the historicity of this first story, but knowing the personalities involved, I have a little trouble believing that something like it certainly happened. There are two Ramim in Yeshiva, two rabbis, two teachers, Gush has a rotation of who takes sabbatical. And a couple of years before I got to Yeshiva, there are two specific rabbis who decided they would take sabbatical together and learn in Gush's, elite kollel. And they would attend the Shirim and they would act as if they were students. And there was one morning Seder when they had been learning together and they got into disagreement about who had been the MVP of the World Series in, say, 1957. I'm giving the year off, but it's something around that. And as one does, one gets into disagreement during morning Seder, and they weren't sure what the answer was, they went to Esther Bilkinson, who purportedly responded that he didn't think it was an appropriate thing to be discussing necessarily during morning Seder, and then proceeded to answer the question for them. The second story I'm going to get the details of this wrong because I tried to look it up, but I couldn't find it. Rav Lichtenstein, on a number of different occasions, spoke about his autobiography, essentially. He presented it to his students, which is a fascinating thing to hear about how he perceived himself in the development of his life. But one of the things that struck me was that when he was a very young child, he grew up in a household that certainly valued Torah, and his father, other than the fact that Yitzmichel was also, I'm pretty sure, had a doctorate as well, was one Stephen learning, but he by no means grew up in an ivory tower. He did not grow up in the house of who we think of as, you know, Gedolei Olam necessarily. His father and both parents really were, you know, very probably truly remarkable people, but not necessarily those we think of when we think of, you know, great men and women of the annals of Jewish history. But he said that when he was growing up, they didn't have very much living in France, but his parents encouraged him greatly to learn, and they said every time he finished a Sefer of Tanakh or a Masechet of Mishnah, it gave him 10 cents. And Rav Lichtenstein went on to finish all of Tanakh and all of Mishnah and all of Shas so that he could buy chocolate to eat because he enjoyed it. And the reason this story struck with me, along with the first story, is that Rav Lichtenstein, in many ways, grew up no differently than many of us. He got to where he was not because by virtue of his genius, although he was a genius. So he had a tremendous memory, tremendous pedagogy and analytical skills, and that's certainly true. But he got to where he was because he worked for it. And at no point did he ever, and that realizing that and then seeing the person that we saw in front of us, the angel we saw in front of us, was on a certain hand the most humbling, but on the other hand the most inspiring thing you could possibly experience, because Rav Lichtenstein did not expect any less of his Talmidim than he expected of himself, and he did not pretend to us that, you know, work is an easy thing to do, and that serving God is an easy thing to do, and the world is a simple place. Rather, he was a child who, you know, needed on a certain level this outside encouragement, and obviously he outgrew that. And when he was a child, he followed baseball just like everyone else. And at a certain point, he outgrew that also. Although, as a very quick aside, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein said that after they made Aliyah, the Rav used to send them baseball clippings of the scores from Boston because he was worried that they would lose their American identity, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself, but not really for now. But that Rav Aharon was a person who lived by example, and that to his last days was in morning Seder, and showing us what it meant to learn in morning Seder, that you sit there and you learn for hours at a time because that is how you're supposed to learn, and that's how you're supposed to, you know, serve God, and that's what he wants of you. And that he didn't just say you should be a good person, he didn't just say you should appreciate that which was going on in the world and recognize that there are things that are, you know, outside the Dalai Lama's base medrash. For instance, after there was a horrible attack for a Tag Mechir, the price tag movement in Israel, where a number of people ransacked and did some really awful things to a local mosque, burned Korans, etc. Rav Lichtenstein didn't just get up in the Beis Medrash and say this is a terrible thing to do, although he did that also. He then proceeded to buy Korans, or I assume he bought them, because I don't know where he got them from, and go to that mosque that had been vandalized to replace their Sifrei Kodesh, as it were, Lahavdil. Rav Lichtenstein, again, was a person who lived by example in every way. And again, I don't mean to suggest that Rav Lichtenstein, even as a child, there aren't stories about how his prodigious skills, and he had remarkable skills. And that is why, and I'm not saying that he ever told us that we could get to where he was, although he did tell us that. But what was most remarkable about Rav Lichtenstein is to consider that he got to where he was and who he was, both in terms of his pure Torah knowledge and in terms of his character by work. And he didn't pretend otherwise. He did not pretend that it came to him naturally. And in fact, lived the opposite. And day in and day out, he was there. And I'm reminded of this. There's the story of when Rabbi Eliezer died in Novos Sibiri Nasan. Two of us, among them, Rabbi Akiva, sat outside the room to make sure he was still okay, and then entered the room after they heard that he was okay. But sat out almost away from him because Eliezer, as we know from the story of Gavin Mitzia, was someone ostracized after he, had very strong feelings about Tanur Shelach Nai. And when after Eliezer died in Erev Shabbos, Rabbi Akiva on Motzei Shabbos, or I guess on Sunday, walked back, and he pronounced, "Alelai Alecha, Rabbi Alelai Mari Alecha." Woe is to me, woe is to us, for your God. Because Hanachta Dor Yasom, you have left us as an orphaned generation. Rav Lichtenstein wrote about that was because Rabbi Eliezer's positions, his halachic positions had really been accepted and then left, and that his Torah wasn't left over. And I know it certainly don't mean to suggest that's true of Rav Lichtenstein in any way, but in a certain sense, Rav Lichtenstein was Meniach Dor Yasom, that he... There is no individual or even group of people who can replace him. However, it is then on us to make sure that doesn't remain to be true. We are his students, not just those of us who learn with him directly, but all of us. And to make sure that Rav Lichtenstein was not meniach hador yasom, it is imperative we consider what it is that he stood for, internalize it, and live as he did. Thank you.
Noach Lerman. He's here? He's not here. Okay. Rav Schneidman.
Down.
Do you want it to be recorded?
Oh, I see.
Do you want it recorded or not?
Whatever you want. I don't usually read from a text, but I'm going to do that tonight. I just want to take a second. I want to tell Yaakov something personal.
It's okay.
Sorry. With the passing of Harav Aaron Lichtenstein last Monday, Aleph Iyar, Bet Rosh Chodesh Iyar, May 20th, 2015, the community of modern Orthodox Jews worldwide has been diminished and its skies darkened. He was, for all in this group, as you had mentioned, whether they were in direct contact with him or not, an anchor of Torah life and study, ethical ideals, and humane values. His presence and his pathway was a bedrock of this faction's Mesorah legitimacy. One may say of him what the Rambam said of the great Rimi Gash, the designated successor of the Rif, Ha'ish Hazeh Mavis, this man is fearsome. Baron too was awesome on account of his vast knowledge, high intellectual level, principled moral standards, radical integrity, and penetrating insight into people and situations. And yet, at the same time, he was a kind man and accessible. if you would overcome trepidation. He was, as many have noted, the matchless Ish HaEshkolot, the man of many parts, combining greatness in Midos HaSeichel, in intellect. He was a Nul Iluy, after all, and eminence in Midos HaMusorios, moral virtues. He was the Sinai Enoke Horim. Possessing an astounding memory, he had phenomenal betius, wide-ranging Torah knowledge. At the same time, his halachic analysis was deep and penetrating. He was an heir to the Brisker Derech and the Rav's carrying it forward, which he shaped in accord with his own approach. He was a great masmid. He was the Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach of our time with respect to halachic psak and guidance. He was the Rav Kook of the current generation because of his avas Yisroel and a respectful attitude to the secular non-dati world. He was a Chofetz Chaim in Midos. He was a Rabbi Akiva in passionate tefillah. He was the outstanding scholar with his broad knowledge of the canon of Western culture and intellectual history. He was the great Torah and Hashkofa essayist, writing with elegance and poetic richness. He was a polymath with a breathtaking range of interests. Excuse me. He was the depth psychologist with his insightful sensitivity to people in all their varieties and nuances. Reb Aaron excelled in all of the 10 areas listed in the Breita recited in Shachas with respect to matters from which we derive fruit, that is, gain benefit in this world, but whose principle remains whole for the world to come. Especially noteworthy is Reb Aaron's Kibud Av Aim. He arranged for his parents to live near him in Eretz Yisrael and oversaw their needs untiringly and unstintingly in their later years so that their lives would be meaningful and dignified to the very end. He was not a none of in the usual sense of the term. He knew who he was, and he was well aware of his level and his depth. He once shared this incident with me. He was invited to give a talk to a Yiddishist group on Talmudic methodology. When he came to the forum, the organizers told him that they expected him to deliver the talk in Yiddish. He had prepared his remarks in a beautiful English, but he rose to the occasion and delivered the talk in Yiddish, which was not his usual language of discourse, and his talk passed muster with the high-level Yiddish-speaking devotees. Reb Aaron expressed pleasure with his accomplishment. It is true, however, that he was a none of in the sense that he did not care for the external trappings of kavod. Not for him the special black hat or the long frock coat. He stood on the cafeteria line with the Talmidim. He drove his car himself. What mattered for him was substance. Was what was thought and said on a high level? Was it authentic? Did it ring true? These are the things that mattered for him. The toho mattered for him, not the baro. He did not wear a beard to the very end, because I believe that he regarded his mission as including openness to modern type seekers, doubters, and perplexed souls. He wanted such people to feel that they could find in him a fraternal listener who respected them and was approachable. I had the good fortune of having a personal relationship with Reb Aaron for close to a decade when we were neighbors living in adjoining buildings on Fort George Hill up here in Washington Heights. Actually, this connection went back to Crown Heights, where his family and my parents-in-law, Ephraim and Evelyn Chesser, lived. The families were friendly and davened in the Young Israel of Eastern Parkway in the days of the legendary Rabbi Harold Kanatovsky. Reb Aaron knew my wife, the late Bela, before I did, because she was friends with his younger sister, Hadassah. Bela Aleha Shalom became good friends with Dr. Tova, Tibodel Chaim, and my two sons grew up together with Reb Aaron's son. My older son is close to Reb Moshe. When my wife Bela passed away and was brought to Israel for burial, Reb Aaron, who had already made Aliyah, delivered a hesped, which was recorded and sent to us on a cassette. It was uplifting that he had honored us by coming and taking an active part in the Levaya. There are two other incidents with regard to my late first wife, which I recall and will mention. The first involves the Matseva inscription. I wrote a text for the Matseva, a longish acrostic piece. I showed it to Reb Aaron, and he pointed out that a lengthy legend like the one I penned is more suitable to a Rosh Bahag, a Torah giant. He saved me from an egregious blunder, and I rewrote it. He helped me at another point after her death. Right before the Yomim Noroim, quite a good deal of time after her demise in December 1976, I fell into a debilitating depression. I recall that on Erev Yom Kippur, I lay on my back and could not get up and get started. Later that day, when the mail came, there was a short one-sheet note from Reb Aaron. It came out of the blue, and it was totally unexpected. I don't even remember what it said, but it was sufficient to give me the lift I needed to get up and proceed. It was as if he had an intuition about my emotional condition and wrote to give me chizuk, and it did. For a period of about 17 years, I was at Yeshiva University as an administrator in the Division of Communal Services, responsible for outreach in the area of chinuch. One of my tasks was to serve as the director of the ECA, the Educators Council of America, a group of modern Orthodox educators, principals, and teachers. We had an annual convention. I took advantage of my relationship with Reb Aaron and asked him to come from Israel and give the keynote address several times. My thought was that his coming would give educators needed chashivos, self-esteem, and all-important guidance. He came several times. The talks he prepared for these appearances are part of his legacy, of the legacy of his writings. One of them is in the volume known as By His Light that was edited by Reuven Ziegler. It is entitled Centrist Orthodoxy, A Spiritual Accounting. The preface notes that it was an address to the Educators Council of America, delivered in Cheshvan 5746 in 1985. It is to this day very worth reading. It is timely. I reread it over the Shabbos to make sure that this was correct, what I was saying. I'm going to conclude with a couple of comments to three specific texts. These include a set of two psukim, a Mishnah phrase, and a Torah phrase that seem especially meaningful when saying farewell to Reb Aaron. Actually, you made mention of the first set of psukim. The first set of psukim that I'm going to mention are from Malachi, Perek Beis, and it's part of the Haftorah of the Sidra of Toldos. I'm not going to read the Ivrit right now, just read the English translation. The teaching of truth was in his mouth, and no iniquity was found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and fairness, and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of a Kohen should safeguard knowledge, and people should seek teaching from his mouth, for he is the messenger of Hashem, master of hosts. These psukim were written about the ideal Kohen, but they could very well have been composed about Reb Aaron. Actually, I'm sure that Reb Aaron regarded those psukim as his guidepost in life. The second phrase that I'm going to mention is the well-known phrase from Avot, about the missions of the one of the missions of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, Vamidu Talmidim Harbe, developed many students. Reb Aaron was successful in developing students according to the interpretation of Hamidu, which sees it as meaning not just teach students, but empower students to stand on their own. Empower them so that they can learn a sugya and analyze it by their own lights. He didn't just impart information, but he taught people how to learn a sugya, any sugya, every subject, independently. And in a sense, as you mentioned, the entire modern Orthodox community, through Talmidim and Talmidim of Talmidim, through his writings, is comprised of his students. Like the Rav, he undertook to guide this group in developing the ability to learn how to live fully integrated lives in contemporary society and confront any and every challenge successfully. The last one. There's a phrase, a Torah phrase, that seems to be particularly apt in saying shalom to Reb Aaron and summing up his life work. Let me introduce it with a little background. While he lived in Washington Heights until he made Aliyah in 1971, Reb Aaron davened on Shabbat mornings with the Yeshiva University Minyan in the Reuben Shul. That's where it was at that time. I participated in this minyan as well. It was a yeshivish minyan, no droshes, on regular Shabbatot. Over the years, there was one exception to that rule of no droshes. That was on the Shabbat in the fraught days of the Six-Day War. The Gaboim asked Reb Aaron to say a few words. I don't remember the droshim, but I remember this, that Reb Aaron quoted and emphasized the phrase in Bechukotai, V'olech etchem komimiyut, and I led you erect. Reb Aaron, by his exceptional life and works, enhanced the komimiyut, the erectness and pride of the modern Orthodox community worldwide, and indeed the general population in Medinat Yisrael over the several generations of his activity. He did it through the thousands of shiurim and sichot, Torah lectures and guidance talks on the highest level. He did it by the extraordinary example of his sterling character and exceptional integrity. He did it by his accessibility to those who needed and sought his advice. He inspired people, increased the spiritual strength of many, many individuals, in fact, that of the community as a whole. The modern Orthodox community was more secure in its faith and commitment, knowing that our heaven-sent Komemiyut Gadol was there in Yeshivat Gush Etzion in Alon Shvut. Yehi Zecherou Baruch.
Noach Lerman.
Take two. Thank you very much, Rabbi Schneidman, Schwartz, Marty Wiesel. There's a story I long thought was myth and recently discovered was probably true. That there was a professor at Princeton, I think Nigel Smith, who held up Paradise Lost, written by Milton. He said, there are three people in the world who understand this book as well as I do. One of them is Professor Stanley Fish. Another is guy Professor Fallon at Notre Dame. Then there's this guy Aaron Lichtenstein, who went to the Middle East and fell off the face of the earth. And to us, it's funny because he didn't fall off the face. We saw the impact he had. I followed him to the Middle East. Went to Gush for a couple of years, and then hitched a ride with him every week to Grus. And some people prepared for the shir. He gave shir on Kiddushin that year and Ramban al Torah. I also prepared for the ride. You didn't schmooze with Rav Aaron, you conversed. He was a natural introvert, but he overcame it to become a great educator. And when I'm trying to think about summarizing his accomplishments and think of Chris encapsulating them in one word, and he would never do it in one word. He would take him 10 minutes to introduce the subject. I think of depth. He was a person, a man of depth, incredible depth. Depth in terms of substance. He knew a tremendous amount about pretty much any topic you'd want to ask him about. And sophistication. He appreciated he could have in his head multiple and even contradictory ideas, concepts, visions for the future, habits that he himself would ingrain. And that's why I think I'll describe his depth in his intellect, in his character, and in his leadership and vision for the community. As a, in his terms of his intellect, what was very, anybody who encountered him for 5 minutes, anybody who came and read any of his works or listened to him for five, if they understood him, if you can understand his, and the last couple decades his speech could be a little slurred, you immediately knew he was a brilliant guy. You immediately saw from his language, his precision, his breadth, his depth, his insightfulness. You could see his brilliance right away. That wasn't hidden. And they saw it early. When he was 10, he was in Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's shir. And when he was 12, he was in Rav Huttner's shir. with the Beis Medrash guys. We're all married. And he was the only clean-shaven guy in the group, then too. I guess he perpetuated that tradition as well. And he was called the Babe. At least he was good at basketball, he said. So that helped out. So they were able to include him in the games and things like that. But in Shir, he was head and shoulders above them. Even then, he was very grateful to Rav Hertner for incorporating him into things later in life. But in terms of his intellect, what you saw more than just his tremendous knowledge base and precision was the depth of his mind, the ability, the way he leavened the information and the intelligence he had with a sensitivity and appreciation that there were multiple avenues of considering a subject. There were multiple ways to think about something. And that you shouldn't automatically, even if you felt strongly, there was a certain way, he approached everything with a natural idea that there was multiple avenues to consider. And it was a very impressive thing to see when you first got there to appreciate. You also saw in the way that he thought about things. You saw it in Shir and you saw it in the way he thought about all sorts of topics. That when he would get up and approach any, he would get up, he would do press conferences or in the car rides. You could ask him about anything, and I often try. People, they, a range of subjects, philosophy, literature, Tanakh, anything, Gemara, random halacha questions. He was always prepared. He gave a 10 to 15 minute discourse as if he had been working on crafting a well-organized, well-thought-out essay for a week. It was remarkable the way his computer had everything on his mind. It was like a computer. It had everything on file. And the way he could sort of outline, it was like a Wikipedia page. You want to just click the next thing, you click the, you know, click that little tab underneath. You could see the details, then he could go back to the bigger area, divide again, whichever area you wanted to go to, back and forth. It was a remarkable feat to behold, and he did that in Shir. He could give 2.5 hour Shirim on a topic, and sometimes I knew he didn't have time to prepare because I saw his schedule that day, and he'd run from meeting with Richard Dole to a doctor's appointment to speaking at Macham Pua, and I knew he hadn't had time to prepare at all, and he gave the Shir the same way he gave the Shir every other day. He prepared for it because he felt it was responsibility, but he didn't need to. He didn't prepare because he forgot it. He prepared because he felt that was his responsibility. Intellectually, that was something that was remarkable to see, but it wasn't just more impressive, I thought, than his intellect, even though that was what I was first impressed by, was his character, his depth of character, how he worked on himself. And he had multiple and contradictory habits of mind and of act, and it was striking to see. He contrasted a sincerity with complexity, a sweetness. He had a certain sweetness about him with a recognition of all the problems in the world and a... He was able to think about things in new and fresh ways despite an absolute fidelity to Torah and Halacha. He was able to balance all that. It was incredible. I'll pick up on a couple of those themes. One of them is his humility. Was just remarkable. Anybody who came across him, perhaps the most pronounced character trait he had was his humility. He was a man who, when he never viewed himself as better than anyone else. He viewed himself, in one sense, he viewed himself in the shadow of his Rabbeim and the Rav, who he once told me he felt he was a babua. He was a shadow of a shadow of the Rav, and you could throw 100 more shadows in there. He felt very much in his shadow, felt very much his job was at the same time, this was the same, he wanted, so, you know, he wasn't hopefully just to be his water carrier. And the Rav very much wanted him to stay in America, wanted him to inherit the crown of being the leader of YU, and he didn't. He left to Israel. He went to Israel to a lone shvut, to a little yeshiva that had fewer people than the amount of people in his shir that he was giving the kolel shir to. And people were surprised he did that, and the Rav was very disappointed with him, but despite his respect for him, despite his humility, he still pushed himself to do that, and that was part of the contrast. But he also saw his humility in the way, and chivalrousness in the way, I remember sometimes when he would give me rides. Later, at one point, I had the opportunity to drive him a couple times in America, and then in Israel, I had some business there that was conveniently in the Gush. I was able to drive to Yerushalayim. First of all, on how he would approach it, he never liked when other people would do favors for him. He didn't like for other people to do his dishes, to do small favors, to give him tremps. I insisted, okay, I'm going the same way. But he was gracious. It was embarrassing for me. But he would also, in the way he opened the door for his wife, every time. Sometimes he was battling some bad leg pain. He always walked around the door, opened up the door. He always did his own dishes. He took out his own garbage. That was who he was. He wasn't looking to be treated special. It was also an existential humility. He didn't think that he or others could really predict the future or accurately describe divine motives in the present. And he was baffled by those who did. He was fond of quoting the Gemara that Bilam thinks he knows the mind of God. He thinks he knows to predict the future. In the meantime, he doesn't know the mind of his own donkey. People, they don't know the mind, you know, people, they don't know what's going on with the animals in front of them. They think they can predict exactly why different actions are happening among humans. They think they can tell you why there's a hurricane in New Orleans. And when people said those things, he condemned it. When people said, oh, this happened, the terrorist attack, these people died because they did this wrong, or people in Hurricane Katrina were killed because they didn't learn Torah or because of the disengagement, he came out very strongly, and people he respected, Greg Rosh Yeshiva, who he respected, he was very clear about how he felt, how you should approach it. And I thought it was a striking balance of this, of his once his humility and another time his willingness to come and declare the truth. I also was always consistently impressed with his ability to balance not just his humility with his strength of purpose, but an intensity. There were certain things he believed in very strongly. And that intensity was still able to have the mildness of purpose. Still didn't have feel he had to fight. There were things he felt very strongly about, and people in the yeshiva very strongly disagreed with him. There were people in the yeshiva who did things that he strongly disagreed with. There was the Machon. There was the Machon Library, which was nicknamed by the Gush guys the Kfira Library. But Lichtenstein, I don't know if he read many of the books in that library. He wasn't a big fan. But Rav Amital, he grew from Rav Amital, and the two of them as co-rosh yeshiva, which is very unusual. And they both were strong personalities. Neither one of them were meek. Neither one of them was shy. But both of them were able to make it work because of a tolerance and a respect that they had for each other. And that's impressive, and there's a reason you don't see very many successful Koresh Yeshiva today. But the two of them worked out, the two of them learned from each other, and they allowed each other to have different domains and grow from there. While his character may be the most impressive thing about him, the potentially the most long-lasting is the leadership he had for our community, the modern Orthodox Tehillim community, the vision he set for us, the ability, how he was able to be an expositor of a vision of balancing Torah Umada, and balancing complexity and commitment. And the way he approached those things, I felt it was clear to him. The way his Alpha and Omega was Torah. He wrote it and he lived it. He showed up in the Beis Medrash every day. He was there in the morning, 3 hours. He was there in the afternoon. His favorite time was to skip out on the office hours and go to the Beis Medrash when nobody was there during the break. He didn't understand why people needed a break. He didn't take a break, unless his wife ordered him to. He was a devoted servant to his wife, not just to God. I remember sometimes driving back in the car and there were calls he was supposed to make. And Tova said, I'm sorry, Aaron, that's it. You're going to have to go to bed when you come back. You'll have to call him tomorrow. Really need to call them. You're going to have to call them tomorrow. That was it. Like Abraham listening to Sarah, he listened to Tova. There was no question about it. He would give, I remember he gave a little chug and he was giving a simple space to Shoeva. Tova walked in. You can finish this question. It's 10:50. Then it's bedtime. And he obeyed her like a child would obey a mother in those circumstances. He obviously, there was more conversations, more substance to it, but he was a person of tremendous seeker of peace in that sense. But in his vision for the community, and Tova perhaps influenced that as well, but in his vision for the community, which he obviously drew from the Rav, but he drew his own ideas. He felt Torah was a critical element of life. He felt you had to work, you know, it was everything he did. That's what he focused on. I would ask him sometimes, when was the last time he had read certain books that he quoted from so frequently? And it was when he was in his early 20s getting his PhD. It didn't stop him from being able to quote them all over. But that was clearly the focus of his life. At the same time, his vision of Torah and his vision of halacha, and he felt halacha was mandatory. And it was a critic, and he was very personally machmir on himself. But he felt that Torah and halacha had a telos. There was a purpose. There was a reason God had set for them to observe. They were there to perfect us, to mold us as people and as a nation, to be a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, and for us individually, that halacha and Torah should bring us closer to God, should closer to goodness, to do what's right walk in the ways of Hashem. That was what he believed, and that's why he was able to successfully and almost seamlessly integrate ideas from outside the world. I remember what he quoted Michael Jordan, from Michael Jordan too, and I'm a big sports fan, big Chicago Bulls fan. He quoted from Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, many of you know, had the flu game. Game 5 against the Jazz, it was 2-2. And Wilkinson said, if Michael, and he was vomiting his guts out, he'd eaten something bad, and most people wouldn't have played. And he said, if Michael Jordan, he got up in front of the base measures the next day, if Michael Jordan could score 38 points and hit a game-winning three on well, flu, we can battle through colds, and we can battle through illness and push through ourselves. That was, he drew on everything. He didn't just draw on Matthew Arnold and Shakespeare and Milton. He drew from everything. He gave a pep talk once based on Newt Rockne, for you in the audience who are familiar. That was, go Irish. So that was, he was able to do that because he understood what his lodestar was. He understood what his goal was. He knew what he was looking for. And he knew what Torah and Halakha were there to help him get for, and therefore he was willing to draw on anything in the world, and even willing to try to bend Halakha, not to throw it out, never to dismiss it, but to allow to, he was willing to be more machmir when he felt it was important, but also much more mako, and seek out leniencies that would be radical if he felt it would be helpful to the personal or communal development. And that was a lesson of his as well. And as we think about him here today and remember the impact he had on all of us individually and our community, the lesson for us is to make sure that he didn't fall off the face of the earth in the Middle East, that he continues to live on in our actions and how we behave, and that we continue to be exponents for the vision and for the character of who he was. Thank you very much.
I know time is late, and in many ways I am not the most appropriate speaker to talk about Rav Aaron, but I'll try nonetheless. You know, I was not a Talmud of Rav Aaron. I did not learn in Yeshivat Har Etzion. Although I did spend a number of Shabbosos in the Gush with some friends of mine, I went to Rav Aaron's sukkah on Hoshana Rabbah. Actually, some of the fellows wanted to kick me out because I showed up wearing my black hat, and they said, "Why is he here?" And Rav Aaron commented something to the effect of, "He wants to learn Torah, what's the problem?" Something to that effect. It wasn't always easy to understand what he was saying. But in recent years, when I would go to Eretz Yisrael to give bechinos, to give tests to the incoming students to YU, I'd spend time talking with Rav Aaron, reviewing the students specifically, going through them and hearing some of Rav Aaron's impressions about the students. And also, when I became the rabbi of the shul, I used time to talk with Rav Aaron because Rav Aaron had wonderful insight, and Rav Aaron also understood some of the tensions that I brought with me, tensions between what goes on in Yeshiva University and what goes on in Mount Sinai. Rav Aaron told me on a number of occasions, "I know Mount Sinai, where do you think Moshe's bris was?" When I once wrote to Rav Moshe, he commented he really doesn't remember his bris. Okay, but the fact is, Rav Aaron understood some of the tensions that I was going through. He understood this community, and I sought him out to get guidance on many of these issues. I am extremely grateful for the time and his generosity, and I also have to thank Rabbi Danny Mann, who largely served as my translator, because Rav Aaron was not so easy to understand the last couple of years, and Rabbi Mann would come with me into these meetings, and afterwards, he would chazer with me what it is that Rav Aaron said, and I gained a great deal from that. When thinking about Rav Aaron, there are two disciplines, two secular disciplines that come to mind, and they are philosophy and literature. Now, just a few words of caveat. The term secular was meaningless when it came to Rav Aaron. For Rav Aaron, literature, philosophy, we heard even about Michael Jordan, any discipline in the world was an opportunity to come toward higher levels of Yiras Shamayim. But Nonetheless, these are the two disciplines, I think, philosophy and literature, that come to my mind and to many others. And when I went on dictionary.com today to look at what the definition of philosophy is and what the definition of study of literature is, in some ways, these two disciplines are opposite. According to dictionary.com, philosophy is a study that attempts to discover fundamental principles in sciences, arts, etc. In other words, the goal of philosophy is to understand the fundamental principle, what drives it all. The goal of a philosopher often is to arrive at a single truth and a precise definition. In contrast, when you study literature, at least the way it's studied today, the goal is to understand the multiple possible meanings of any given text. It's not about understanding one correct meaning. There are many different possible meanings. And this stira, this contradiction between philosophy and literature, I think is important in understanding Rav Aaron. A large chunk of Rav Aaron was literature. His regular shiur was, and I heard shiurim from him, he would come to yeshiva every year, he would speak in the kollel, he would do Shabbos in YU, which was always a highlight. He would have these press conferences that we heard about before at Shabbos. And every shiur that Rav Aaron gave was the way literature is studied, in terms of trying to understand the multiple possible meanings of a source. You take a Gemara, and what can it possibly mean? And you go through all of the possibilities. He would outline the possibilities at the beginning, and then he would try to put Rishonim into it. Rav Aaron's approach, in this sense, was different than the Rav. Rav Soloveitchik would also analyze multiple possibilities, but Rav Soloveitchik did it with a much more limited library. The Rav would teach Gemara, Rashi, Tosis, Rambam. That's it. Rav Aaron, and I think this may have come from one of his other Rebbeim, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichron Lefracha. Rav Aaron had a much bigger corpus of texts that he drew upon. In Rav Aaron's shiur, it was standard that you would hear from the Rav Yonah or Zerua and the Sefer HaTrumas, and he would organize, Rav Schechter showed me a brief note that someone wrote about how the first time he heard a shiur from Rav Aaron, he heard that there are different schools of thought among Rishonim. The Chachmei Sfarad say it like this, and Chachmei Ashkenaz say it like this. And for Rav Aaron, the possibilities are always, is it X or is it Y, or maybe it's a combination of both X and Y. And he would put those together and focus on a lot of this gray area, very often going back to Torah Shebiksav and trying to draw on the values that came from Torah Shebiksav. But ultimately, a shiur that Rav Aaron gave was an effort to try to uncover many different possibilities. And very often, I remember talking to Rav Schechter about this the first time I heard a shiur from Rav Aaron in YU, I felt more confused at the end of the shiur than I did at the beginning. Because at the beginning of the shiur, I felt I knew the Gemara, then at the end, I'm like, oh my gosh, I have no idea what happened here. And one time at one of these press conferences in YU on the Friday night, one of my friends decided to have the guts to ask Rav Aaron how come he teaches this way, and whether the Rav taught this way. And Rav Aaron responded something to the effect of, if you're in college and you're studying history and literature and science, whatever you're studying in a sophisticated and nuanced sort of way, you have to realize that Torah is as sophisticated and as nuanced and as profound as anything else that you're going to study. So for Rav Aaron, there was a conscious decision made. Now, again, he was an extremely sophisticated thinker, and he could generate possibilities out of nowhere. That's all true. But he made a conscious decision to teach in a methodological way. Rabbi Rosenzweig spoke about this in his Hesped, to be Ma'amid Talmidim. That's like what Rabbi Schneidman was saying. But also, he deliberately tried to teach in a complicated sort of way, to analyze so many possibilities that you can't generate on your own, to show you that this is all possible. This is all within Torah. And Chochmas HaTorah, Torah wisdom, is more profound than any secular discipline out there. That was one aspect of Rav Aaron. So that's the literature aspect. But then there's the other aspect, the aspect of trying to arrive at one truth. Not multiple truths, not multiple possibilities. And for Rav Aaron, there are many times that he said, this is it. There's only one truth. And these issues often were issues that many others felt were very complicated. And many others, even other Gedolim, would say, you know what? I could see this but many different ways. Rav Aaron said, no, there's one truth, one way, that's it. Some of the things that came to mind, of course, are from recent years. Rav Aaron was a critic of the other Rashi Yeshiva and Yeshiva Tester in recent years. After Baruch Goldstein murdered 29 people in Maras HaMachpelah, right before Purim in 1994, and then some of the Yeshivot Hester had hespedim for Baruch Goldstein, and they treated him like a great tzaddik. There's a book that came out, Baruch HaGever, about how wonderful Baruch Goldstein was. Rav Aaron penned an open letter to the other Rosh Yeshivot of Yeshivat Hester saying, Lo ye osa kem b'mkomeinu. It's wrong. You can't do it. And they tried to fight back. They said, Tol korim b'nei necha. It's your fault because you support the peace process. And he hit him back. He hit back. Rav Aaron said, no, this is immoral and it's wrong. You can't do it. Rav Aaron spent an awful lot of time, when a particular Rosh Yeshiva, a number of years ago, was abusing his students. Rav Aaron listened, as he said in one of his shiurim afterwards, it's not so easy to have to close the Gemara. And from Rav Aaron's perspective, it's really not so easy. And he came up publicly. He came up publicly about that person who had been to Rosh Yeshiva, because it's wrong. Others would come up with excuses and try to defend. No. Rav Aaron had one way of looking at things. A number of Rashi Yeshiva and Rabbonim drafted an open letter a few years ago. In that open letter, they said, based on Gemaras and Rishonim, that it's forbidden to sell or rent land in Israel to Arabs. Rav Aaron said, absolutely not. There's no multiple ways. By the way, this is a sugya that there's so many different Rishonim, and a person could look at the sugya and say, well, maybe the Ravid's position is correct, maybe the Ramban's position is correct. Rav Aaron did not do that. It was a moral issue. And moral issues for Rav Aaron are absolutely black and white. There's nothing to talk about. He comes out publicly, he says, no, no excuses, it's wrong. He drafted a public letter, and he said, this is what has to be done. In my own conversations with Rav Aaron, the two issues that we spoke about the most are, I think, the two issues that are central to the modern Orthodox community now, which are the role of women and the role of gays in the Orthodox community. I had two extensive conversations with Rav Aaron on these issues. He imparted a great deal of wisdom with his understanding, but also thinking very far ahead. Rav Aaron was not a person who was ambivalent about modernity. Rav Aaron had no ambivalence whatsoever. He was, this is proper, this is right. When it came to women's education, Rav Aaron, we heard Rabbanit Esti speak at her father's Lavaya. We know about Rav Aaron's strong role in supporting women's Talmud Torah, even stronger than the Rav. The Rav gave one shiur in Stern. That was it. That was it. He gave one shiur. The Rav, in theory, was a great champion, but he handed it over to his students. Rav Aaron was much more open to women's education. Women's education without watering it down. Often people who teach Torah and teach Torah to women, they say, oh yeah, it's okay, you know, we'll do a little bit and you make them feel good and we'll say a Gemara here and there. Rav Aaron gave the same shiur. Now, again, his shiur was as unintelligible to the men as it was to the women. There's no question. But there is something to be said that Rav Aaron was a tremendous, tremendous champion. And Rav Aaron also, in the conversations I had with him about the difficult issue of the role of gays and lesbians in our community, Rav Aaron just kept on looking at me and he said, you have to understand and you have to do what's right. Like, it's not like a political calculation. He just felt that what's right is right. Again, there were lines. Rav Aaron had clear lines. There's no question. No one would say that Rav Aaron was halachic. Someone suggested earlier that Rav Aaron sometimes bent halach and looked for lenient positions. I don't think so. I think Rav Aaron probably, on a personal level, was striving to do more than the strict halacha, but would never bend halacha at all. Rav Aaron's integrity was too strong to bend halacha. But Rav Aaron's wisdom, this is a man who is born in Paris, a man who's coming from a completely different world, but he's so much more modern, so much more advanced than progressive, whatever the term is, than others. And I remember talking with Rabbi Wurzberger after the Rav was Nifter. And we were talking about the Rav and whether there's anyone who replaced the Rav. And Rabbi Wurzberger's line was that he thinks that there are replacements for the Rav, but there's no individual who can fill in for the Rav on his own, but you take a few students and you put them together and you could create the Rav. Like if they said at Rav Moshe Twersky's Levaya, Shem Yikum Domo, that he was grandfather, or whatever the line was, I think Rav Moshe Twersky was the same type of Talmud Chacham that the Rav was. I believe it. But I don't believe for a second that Rav Moshe Twersky had the breadth of knowledge in other areas that the Rav had. I don't think Rav Moshe Twersky heard the titles of half of the books that the Rav would quote. Rabbi Wurzberger, who I was exposed to, understood the Rav's philosophy without any question. Without any question. Rabbi Wurzberger used to tell me about how he remembers the Rav getting stuck in Shiur on the Rambam, and he'd say, Nu Aaron, what does the Rambam say? Rav Aaron, of course, knew it. So I think the Rav had a replacement in the sense of different Talmidim can encompass different parts of his personality. Rav Aaron, precisely because he, unlike the Rav, combined philosophy and Torah in his shiurim. Rav Braunschweiger could say about the Rav that he never saw the Rav with a secular book open, and it's true. It's true. Because that wasn't the Rav who Rav Braunschweiger knew. But Rav Aaron was Tocho Kevaro. Rav Aaron, everything about him was Torah Umada. And I don't know. I don't know if our community has people who can replace him. I know that to a certain extent, Haida Difna Mechavroi, Deraisi Reb Aaron Meachorov. The advantage that I had is that I was able to forge some sort of small connection with Reb Aaron, even though it was in the years when he was already in decline. But the amount of wisdom that I gained, just seeing him, just hearing him say a Kaddish and exude Yiras Shemayim, that's something that will stay with me forever. So, Rav Aaron, who in many ways is the opposite of what people thought, on issues that people felt were very simple, like a simple piece of Gemara, Rav Aaron found it very complex. Issues that others found complex, Rav Aaron found simple. In many ways, I think this is representative by something that Rav Aaron would probably quote, which is a poem from Robert Frost. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in the wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I think Rav Aaron was much more ambitious than anyone else. He took that road less traveled, and we're all fortunate to have him, as part of our worldview to a limited extent. Yehi zichro baruch.